I'm now shifting ever so slightly, but I'm shifting to an adjacent argument, and it'll be brief. It's about knowing now rather than loving. Check your own experience to see whether this is true for you. Coupled with our yearning for love is our experiencing the desire to know. And I think it's actually secondary. I think the desire to love is the primary engine driving us. And because I want to be in communion with you, I want to know you. Because I want to be in communion with the world, I want to know the world. Because I, the 2-year-old, the 3-year-old, the 71-year-old, who want to be part of the cosmos, then I look into the whole of the astrology and astronomy and the rest of it that's going on, insofar as I'm able to. So there's this, we keep learning to trust our desire to know as well, as we discover more and more truth. Yet our desire to know, impelled by our desire to love, is also limitless. Partial knowledge always leaves us unsatisfied. We want a fully satisfying explanation of reality. We want all our questions answered. That our desire to know can be satisfied in small ways, and we know when this is not a subjective thing. We know when we know. Sometimes we think we know and we're wrong, but we know when we know. And it's the reason for it, which is a really profound and very simple philosophical point. I can still remember the day I got the insight into this in philosophy. That knowing, it's not as if I know that out there. I know you. I think I know you. And then I can reflect and check whether I really know you or I'm interpreting you wrongly, you know, like as a second act of reflection. That's not the way it works. You can have those second acts of reflection. But the actual reality of knowing is bipolar in that sense. I know you in knowing myself. That's not a secondary thing. It doesn't come as a secondary act of reflection. It's I'm knowing you when I know you. So it's there in the very same act of apprehension is a recognition that I am knowing something real. So our desire to know can be satisfied in small ways, and this encourages us to trust that there exists a reality that can satisfy our yearning for ultimate truth. It's this reality that we call God. Just as the reality of unlimited love is what we mean by God. And since prayer is communion with God, should not we expect prayer to be an experience of truth? Not an escape, but a more profound depthing of what we find within our own heart and what we have discovered in our communion with people. That's prayer, communing with God. That's the Thomistic argument from contingency, really. Everything that exists, I exist, but I'm not self-explanatory. I just exist. I am here. But if the more you know about me, that doesn't account for my being. And I'm not talking about the fact that I had a mum and dad. I'm talking about now, right at this particular second, now, I exist. So do you. But you do not account for your own existence. You're not self-explanatory. You exist because you're held in existence by God. When we turn our gaze away from our longing and focus instead on that which we come to know and love, we realize that reality is not a compilation of discrete, unconnected individual entities. Everything is in some way interconnected. Modern science impresses this truth upon us, from astronomy to ecology to biology. This interconnectedness of being points to the existence of a being in which everything participates and which is the ultimate reason for the interconnection that we experience. We all belong because we are all expressions of the ultimate reality, and we're giving the name God to that ultimate reality. This raises the question of God. Furthermore, since prayer is a communion with God, should we not expect our prayer to bring us to a more perfect communion with the world and with our real selves? When and to the extent that your or my prayer is genuine, I'm talking about those silent moments when we are alone with the mystery, then I will become more real about myself and I'll become more real about you. If I don't become more real about myself and don't become more real about you, I would be very suspicious of what's happening when I'm in prayer, because I'm out of connection with the ultimate reality. And didn't Jesus say, by their fruits you will know them? If I become more proud, more looking for power, more disconnected, more dysfunctional, then I need help to actually pray, because the communion with God will necessarily bring about a journey such as I've described. Another dimension of everything and of every person that we know and love is that when we ask why they exist, we have to look beyond them to find the answer. I'm not concerned here with the question of why they came to exist. Obviously, trees grow from seeds, babies need parents. I'm saying that if something now exists, I'm repeating myself here, they must exist now, there must exist a being that fully accounts for this fact. The limited objects that we experience do not in themselves satisfactorily explain why it is that they are now existing. They are, as the philosophers say, contingent. Nor is our question satisfactorily answered by pointing from one contingent, that is, not self-explanatory being, to another, whose existence also needs explanation. And we go on and on and on, everything leaning on everything else and nothing with a foundation. Ultimately, there must exist now a being which provides the ultimate and fully satisfactory reason for the existence of everything that is, and which, unlike everything we know, does not require the existence of some further being to account for its existence. This is the reality that we call God. God is the creating source, the sustaining ground, and the final goal of all that we experience, including ourselves. Should we not then expect our communion with God, our prayer, to bring us to a realization that all we are and all we have, including our connections with reality, are gifts coming from the source of all existence? It is love, the love that is God, that sustains everything in being and that binds everything together. So I'm conclude now with the second number of the catechism that I said I'd cover, number 2567, which reads So far all I've done is try and touch elements of your experience of love, of knowledge, of interconnectedness to make the point that while we cannot produce the kind of evidence that will convince the logical mind, it can be shown to be reasonable, to be open to the existence of God, which will only be discovered by a heart that is ready to love. So it's a love journey we're on. And the mind will go as far as it can, come to its limits, and love will follow the pointers that the mind gives, because the mind can't go all the way, because it's too frail an instrument. But all the pointers that the minds follow make for the world to be meaningful and not absurd, require us to dare that journey into mystery, which is the journey into God. So the Catechism reads, God calls us first. We may forget our Creator, we may hide far from His face, we may run after idols or accuse the Deity of having abandoned us. Yet the living and true God tirelessly calls each person to that mysterious encounter known as prayer. In prayer, the faithful God's initiative of love always comes first. We don't begin prayer, we respond in prayer. We go into prayer knowing that God is there, reaching out to us. That's our beginning point. So we need clearly to make a focus our attention on the fact that God is there calling me into communion. And that's how we begin. As God gradually reveals Himself and reveals us to ourselves, prayer appears as a reciprocal call, a covenant drama. Through words and actions, this drama engages the heart. It unfolds throughout the history of salvation. So, finally, what do we do? These are just a few images that might help you. And then next week and the week after, I'll take you through the scriptures and look at the Old Testament prayer and then the New Testament prayer to give examples of our tradition of prayer. Well, I conclude by asking you this. These are the things that we can do in prayer. One, a surfer has to struggle out to the deep beyond the breakers. But once you're there, you have to wait for the wave. You don't create the wave. But if you don't do the work of getting out, if you sit on the sand, you won't enjoy the surf. But when you get there, you just wait. A silkworm spins the silk, but has to wait for the time for the emerging of new life. Butterfly, is it? The moth. It's up to us to clear debris that blocks the spring. But when we clear away the debris, we have to wait for the water. We don't create the spring. A sailor has to unfurl the sail. But if you're in the doldrums, you're in the doldrums. You have to wait for the wind, and you don't create it. So it is with prayer. Ultimately, it's a process of waiting. But in prayer, we know in faith, even if we don't experience it, that God is certainly offering Himself to us.